Always.
Where we have the only graduate program that's specifically in the other here is Washington.
Really?
Yeah. It would have been something a little different if that had been. So the guy who took it over there, he didn't. He's all about it.
No way. I mean, that's important too.
I'll mention yours because it's first female speaker. So there.
Last in the back until.
That's fine.
But still, we don't. Oh, yeah, mine comes right after that.
Okay.
Thank you.
If everybody could grab a seat, we'll get started. Please be sure to check at the very back on the marble topped shelf, there are booklets that we'll need to get the work done today. And hopefully some of you have heard we will have food. We're going to have a pasta bar with Arnold Palmer drinks, which sounds sexy, but it's just lemonade and iced tea. but so those of you that are towards the back, you need to know that that's where they're going to be serving the food. We tried to get a bigger room with tables, but John got that room for the last session. So John Valdez, you got the better room. So hopefully everybody has their booklets, and you're in a special session, which will begin soon, 4:30 to 6, and it's entitled Environmental Health Nursing and Climate Change. The idea here is that we have a panel of distinguished presenters. They are not listed in the book because of deadlines that needed to be met for the booklet. But we will give them their due honor as we present them. What you did see was my name, Laura Anderko from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Liz Blackburn from USEPA, and Stephanie Chalupka. And we had this great idea last year with the Environmental Health Nurse Working Group, which is a subsection of the Public Health Nursing Section, to put together a interdisciplinary session of nurses and non-nurses, sanitarians, researchers from other disciplines, so that we could address the issue of global climate change and come up with a strategic goal, just one, for the year, where we could work together collectively with other disciplines and make a difference. So I'm going to do one more quick housekeeping piece that uses the workbooks. I do want to acknowledge Healthcare Without Harm, which gave us funding to print the books up, funded some of the food. Brenda Afsel, please stand. Healthcare Without Harm. And there are a couple things about the booklet I want to just make sure everybody is aware of. We've got the schedule on the front, and as you can see, we have a series of speakers on different topics. If you turn the pages, you'll also see Environmental Health Nursing Principles, which was developed through the Public Health Nursing Section, the Environmental Health Nurses Group. You'll also see the ANA reference, and I think Holly is here. Holly, if you want, there, from the ANA. And if you are particularly good at this time of the day, you'll also notice that I reuse my paper when I print things off. And my secretary followed my directions exactly. I said, use back-to-back. And she did, but she didn't look at the fact there's a grant written on the back of those pages. Which I happily can say we got funded. But, and now you have actually extra added value because you have a grant that was funded that you can use. But anyway, so just put an X out on the back of those pages. The idea is to acknowledge that ANA has a reference related to global climate change and human health that we might want to use in our conversation. And at the very, very back, you will see, you will also see a worksheet that we're hoping to create some conversation over our pasta and our Arnold Palmer drinks. And come up with a goal for the next year. Also, I don't want to miss the fact that Stephanie and Liz were very, very instrumental in getting a resource booklet out. I guess you would call it a booklet.
Guide.
And the website is on there. It's Stephanie, you want to tell people where it's posted?
It's posted on the Harvard School of Public Health, BU Superfund Basic Research site. So it's www.ehnursing.org.
And it's,
it has lots of resources for nurses and the environment. www.ehnursing.org.
And there's one page that was copied. There's many, many, many pages. There are acknowledgments as well. There are a lot of folks that helped us fine-tune the information. Liz had a graduate student that helped us do the research to get that information together in one place, and we're hoping that all sorts of folks take the opportunity to use that. One last thing. You will see in the very beginning, December 12, 2008, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, we will be having a follow-up conference call to keep us on task with what we promise we're going to do today. And the phone number and the passcode are listed on the slide, but they're also listed in the book. We also will be having is the sheet passing around? So we will have you sign in blood that you are here, you had pasta, and you committed to reducing the effects of global climate change.
Will you get our emails?
Yeah, please put your name and your email so that we can find you and let you know and give you reminders about the phone call as well. We were required to put up the disclosure slide, and there are no relationships to disclose financially for Barb or any of our presenters today. So any questions before we get started? Nope? All right. It's with great pleasure that I introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Barb Sattler. She is a friend and a colleague, and we call her the goddess, one of the goddesses of environmental health nursing, because there can be more than one goddess. She is the director of the Environmental Health Education Center at the University of Maryland School of Nursing. And if you don't know Barb, you should know Barb, because she's very, very much instrumental in getting environmental health incorporated into nursing education and getting folks fired up about it. She is a professor, and she will be talking to us, introducing us to the whole issue of global climate change and human health. And I will let Stephanie and Liz introduce our other speakers after Barb is finished. Please help me welcome Barb Sattler.
Thank you. I'm, as ever, very happy to be here in a room that is, I believe, mostly nurses. But I like those other folks too, whoever you may be. But nurses really are my primary audience and have been for 10, 15, maybe 20 years now. And I'm going to be speaking to, oh boy, I'm not going to be speaking. Oh, is that why it's all duct taped?
Yeah, it looks like it's on though.
Hello. It's a small room.
Oh, there we go. That's
I won't touch that anymore. I promise. But I'm Irish and German, and I talk with my hands. If somebody could please explain that to me, which is why I'm always bumping the thing in front of me. So I'm doing what is the warm-up for global warming, and we've got some very, very excellent speakers that are coming after me. But I think that what I want you to really begin to do right now is think about what you're comfortable with, because what I'm going to ask you to do at the end is to do things you're uncomfortable with. So let me just begin. How many of you have seen Al Gore's movie? Okay, I figured that. So I was going to start from there rather than start there and just say some of the things that I think are complementary to that. So you've all seen these photographs, whether it's of the southern coast or whether it's from a globe and, you know, as a whole, that are pretty frightening in terms of what we might expect if global warming continues in the trajectory that it's currently going. And so a lot of times the pictures that we see are pictures that depict what I'm going to just generally call the global south, as though the global south is where global warming is going to happen and nowhere else. It is going to happen in the global south, so make no bones about it, and it's going to be worse for many of our most challenged communities. It's going to be worse, and it's going to be an incredible social justice issue. But I want to talk a little bit about what we might see in the U.S. and how poorly we are prepared, even here, with the incredible resources that we have here. And so what we're expecting to see in a variety of places are massive displacement, and the displacement may come from flooding, but the displacement may also come from a variety of other reasons that I'm going to talk about. And we're not prepared. We're not prepared for that globally. We also know that we're going to see, and we're already in Science Magazine, there was an article in 2006, we're seeing longer and more often we're seeing forest fires. This means habitat displacement. This means destruction of property. It means increase in air pollution. It means human health threats and threats to our security, our economy, and other things as well. We know that we're seeing increased storm activity, and we've seen that just with both the hurricanes as well as the tornadoes just in the last several years. The level of destruction that happens there is phenomenal, and once again, we're seeing those kinds of things right here in the U.S. This really brings the idea of habitat destruction to a whole other level of visualization. We know that we've lost a number of homes that have not been replaced after the various storms that occurred over the past couple of years. These pictures are not, in fact, from the global south, though when you see them straight away, you might think they are. These are photographs that were happened during the aftermath of Katrina. How many folks here did any kind of work after Katrina? Yeah, you're my public health buddies. Brenda and I went down there with the University of Maryland Wellmobiles. These are like bookmobiles that are made up as clinics. And what we discovered when we went down there, and this was in the immediate aftermath, was that we were so not prepared. And in my heart of hearts, I don't think we're so much more prepared now for anything like this either. And while we've spent a lot of money on preparing for chemical and biological and nuclear warfare, that doesn't always translate to how we're going to take care of people through the devastation of natural causes, through flooding and storms and the kinds of things that we're expecting to see in increasing numbers, of, you know, starting now. These are pictures from New Orleans, and they're pictures of places in New Orleans that continue to look exactly like this. What makes us think that we can take care of people's homes if there's no evidence that we could take care of their homes after Katrina? There's no evidence that we have brought them back to anywhere near where they need to be in terms of their basic security and their homes. Since 1980, Matthias is a scientist at the University of Maryland who has looked at the economic impacts of storms, just storms. And since 1980, we have surpassed $560 billion worth of destruction from storms in the U.S. And that includes major infrastructure, you know, in terms of bridges, in terms of transportation, and other things. We're looking at water and wastewater facilities that can be destroyed and have been destroyed over the last few years with the increases in storm, as well as energy and communications. We know that water security issues also are going to be disproportionately borne by people who are already the most challenged from a variety of issues in their lives. We know that we're going to see excessive droughts. We're going to see excessive droughts in parts of this country, in parts of this country that are currently fertile, parts of this country that are currently supplying us with food, as well as the kinds of droughts that they're already seeing are going to worsen and expand in the global south, creating, once again, this incredible displacement and the horrors of what we're already seeing there escalated. We also know that this is going to, especially what's going to be happening with water issues and water security issues and food security issues, we're going to be seeing serious political and economic upheaval. And that challenges our security here as well. We know that climate-related changes are going to be affecting our crops, both the quality of the crops and the quantity of the crops, and that there's going to be need to be some changes, serious changes in how we're doing agriculture as we begin to adapt to the changes in our climate. We also know there are food security issues right now that are associated with storms. So in Central America, when Hurricane Mitch hit Central America, 18,000 people lost their lives. And these children that are in the bottom left are standing in food lines. Many of them lost their family members, including their parents. So they were orphaned by the various weather and climate change activities just over the last few years. We know that in addition to threatening our food supplies, this also is going to threaten our family farms that are the bedrock of our communities in many of our rural areas. We know that it is also going to threaten migrant workers who constitute millions of people in this country who are floating around, often undocumented, often untracked, but they will be even more displaced and even more inconvenienced by the weather patterns that we might expect. Excessive heat is something that one of my graduate students, is Linda Lindquist in the room today? She's not here. Linda Lindquist, one of my graduate students, who is currently doing some work on how well cities are prepared to deal with heat exposure. And you probably remember that in 1995, over 600 people died in Chicago of heat-related illness. And so she began to look at some cities, not just in the United States, but also in Europe, because they had other similar situations with heat waves in Europe. She's looked at Toronto. And what she's discovered is, we ain't ready for this. We're not even ready for excessive heat. Now, when we talk about global warming, you would think somebody would be paying attention to the words. We're going to be warming up. And And our city health department, as well as the city health departments around us in areas that are addressing millions of people, do not have a plan that interdigitates with the aging departments, the health departments, the police, the cooling centers that are under a separate jurisdiction. It is phenomenal how, on this issue alone, for those of you who are in local health departments, look and see what your plan is. And as public health people, using your public health, you know, lens, see if it even makes sense on paper. And then what we discovered is they often are good on paper, and then none of the agencies know they're on this piece of paper. Now, that was true with preparedness a while back. I'm hoping that that's changed a little bit now, but, you know, that's just because I'm Pollyanna. But on this one, I know it's not true. So there are lots of places that have these plans on paper, and they have never brought the agencies together. And this is one, again, where our most vulnerable populations need to be tracked. We need to know where they are. We need to know whether they're mobile. Could they get to a cooling center even if they knew where it was? We have a lot of work to do just on this one basic thing. Somebody was talking the other day about the possibility of being able to actually prescribe air conditioners and have it paid for by Medicare when you've got an aged person who is at risk for hyperthermia. And I think that's a brilliant idea we should think about. So the range of health effects are wide. And you have also, I'm sure, all, you know, have some sense of it, both from the sense of infectious diseases, the vector-borne diseases that we're going to see different patterns in, and then just all the things that will be sequela to not having the same nutrition and food access and so forth. And I want to mention something about food, because this was, as I started over the last year to try and learn myself about global warming, there's a lot of talk about energy, and I think it's incredibly important, and it should be top priority, energy and transportation, manufacturing, absolutely. But what's interesting to me is that one-fifth of the, now this is globally, this is not just in the United States, one-fifth of the greenhouse gases are produced in the production of meat and dairy, but in particular in meat. And that some of it is produced by the ruminants themselves in terms of their own little greenhouse gases that they're producing, but also some of it is produced because they eat corn, which is produced, and in the process of producing it and transporting it and so forth, that is also creating greenhouse gases. And because everybody once looked like the U.S., all over the world now we're seeing changes in food patterns and moving towards meat-based, more meat-based diets. Well, we need to help turn our patterns around here so the rest of the world will see that we're serious about it when we go to their countries and ask them to do the same thing. One of the other things that's, I think, really telling is that 70% of what were former forests in the Amazon right now have been cleared, and we know, okay, so you've taken away the carbon sink that was those trees, and you've now created land for pasturing, for meat production, for meat consumption. So I know that in the last, I think it was year and a half, and this is all data from the UN and an incredible report from the UN about meat production and its contribution to global warming. And this is a little one because I work a lot with hospitals. So we've begun to talk to hospitals and try and figure out, okay, how do we reduce our energy consumption? How do we reduce our water consumption? How do we make use purchasing to purchase products with less toxicity? How do we do any number of things? And then we've got a menu of options of things that we do with food as well, choosing local, sustainable, organic, seasonal, no bovine growth hormones, without pesticides, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things we're beginning to talk to our hospitals about is let's go with a meatless Monday. And not because we're vegetarians, but because we're concerned about global warming. So let's think about that. It's just another approach. So when I was reading about this stuff, how many of you learned about Maslow's hierarchy of all of us, right? I didn't remember what it was. I just remembered basically what it was. But when I think about global warming, this is what I think about what's happening to humanity. Okay. So physiological. This is where food, water are basic human needs to survive. This is where, and shelter. safety, this is where we have law and order, where we have protection, where we have employment, where we have a sense of sort of order in our lives. This is where we have family relations, relationships with our work cohorts. And this is where we begin to have a sense of ourselves and a sense of identity. And up here is where we have a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning in our life. And what Maslow suggested is that you can't move up the pyramid until you make sure that you've satisfied these. And what I would suggest to you is global warming is threatening humanity's bottom rung. And that we are going to be living in a society that is no longer going to be invested in those things that we consider beautiful and creative and loving and worthwhile. And to me, this is a desperate call for us to do something about this. So we know that global warming is going to equal planetary destruction. And we know that this is our greatest public health challenge. And we must rise to this challenge. The things that we're seeing already and that we expect to see are just fundamentally going to be undermining our humanity. And the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, who this is not a picture of, however, it is a picture of R.K. Pachauri. You know, sometimes we do it right, sometimes we don't. But suggested that our next president, God willing, I'm not going to tell you who it is, and I'm not biased. Our next president is going to, in fact, have a major challenge and going to be a major contributor to the global decisions around global warming. And we need to be there supporting those and pushing them and making sure they don't get lost in the shuffle of economic distress that we're in right now. And so one of the things I'd like you to suggest that you may want to look at, there are a wonderful group of scientists that have created a plan. They've met with both the Republicans and the Democrats, and they've suggested a climate action plan that is based on efficiency, renewables, and equity, that looks in this country at the creation of green jobs. And this is the correct first part, but it's .com. I apologize. climateactionproject.com. And you will see in that on that website the actual recommendations for what we have to do to turn things around, starting the first 100 days. So I'd like to suggest to us that we've got to think globally. We've got to act globally. And maybe not each of you individually, but we've got to, as a nation, we've got to be acting globally. We've got to figure out nationally what our contribution is, which we know is huge. We've got to work at a state level. We've also got to work in our institutions, whether they're a hospital, whether they're a clinic, whether they're a health department, and we've got to work at our homes. And we can't leave any part out. We've got to be operating on all fronts. And it's a time for all hands on deck. And we as public health people are fix-it people. And this is a chance for us to really get involved in that act. We have to be working at our highest level of discomfort. How many of you work to make policies within your own departments or clinics or so forth? How many of you do that? Okay, pretty comfy with that, right? I'm asking you, if that's your only level of comfort, I want you to now begin to work at your state level. How many of you work at the state level? Okay, so you're pretty comfy with that. I want you to be working at the national level. Not just me. We have to. You have to, because you were comfortable with the other level. I'm dragging everybody now to their place of discomfort. How many of you work nationally? Well, you guys, you got the big chore. And this doesn't mean you stop working where you did. This means that you start moving it out globally. And we must do this, and we must do this, and we must do this as if our life depended on it. And with that, I'm going to let the rest of folks talk. Thank you.
Well, Well, that was an excellent way to kick it off. I'm going to ask those of you who want to come up front, they're going to put food back there, so you may not want to be sitting on it. So there's a few seats up here if you want to just come and sit up here and not sit on the food. Our next speaker is Dr. Howie Frumkin. He probably doesn't need an introduction to most of you, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's required. He is the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Environmental Health and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, which, as you all know, has the task of improving health by promoting healthy environments and preventing premature deaths and illness caused by environmental exposures. Just a little task. I think I met Howie when he was the director of the Region 4 Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit. And then soon after, he joined the EPA Children's Health Protection Advisory Committee and led two task groups and wrote two important letters to the administrator, one on global climate change and children's health. I think for the first time shouting out that there's a connection between global climate change and children's health. And also smart growth and children's health and how important it was to address those issues. He doesn't just confine himself to those small little topics. He also has helped to author a book on school environment, healthy school environments. He's done a whole variety of other things. He is such a unique player in our world. He is unique because he is both visionary, but he gets the job done at the same time, and that is so important in our work. But most importantly, I really call Howie my friend. So please welcome my friend, Howie Frumkin.
Thank you very much, Liz. I'm actually, the other credential you forgot to mention is I'm president of the Liz Blackburn Fan Club. I'm hoping somebody knows how to work this thing. Yeah. I have a relationship to reveal.
You're not black, you're right.
So let's see. This. Oh, yeah, there we go. Oh, no, it's okay.